I'm Owen Bennett-Jones in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection. Democrats and Republicans can agree on one thing, that everyone has the right to protest, to get out onto the streets with a placard to make his or her point. But after that, it starts getting trickier. No one minds a placard in a designated area because, well, perhaps because it doesn't really bother anyone. But what happens if people go outside the designated areas and start becoming more disruptive? Where do the limits lie? Well, that issue is likely to be tested in New York soon enough when the Republican Party gathers for its convention. All sorts of events are planned, traditional rallies, a mass flash by women complaining of a political cover-up, and a human chain with people linking themselves with bicycle locks so as to block roads. And there are also suggestions it could turn violent, possibly with news media vans being attacked. Well, today we're talking about the debate over dissent and security at the RNC. Do you think the protesters are being given the space and opportunity to make their voices heard? Or do you think the government is doing the right thing to help stop trouble before it starts? And what do you make of the FBI's questioning of activists? Is it reasonable, a precaution, or an unwarranted breach of civil liberties? The number, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's begin today in New York. Jamie Moran is there. He's one of the founders of rncnotwelcome.org. That's a resource website of RNC protesters. It's the main clearinghouse for demonstrators and activists planning to make their various points in New York. Now, Jamie Moran, I know you have concerns about being seen as a protest organizer for legal reasons, but with that caveat, tell us, what sort of protests do you think there will be in New York?
Well, thanks for having me on, Owen. There are going to be a lot of different events planned, but for one, I just want to start by saying that despite all this fear that's being spread, it's important to note that in a recent poll by WABC, 83% of New Yorkers did not want the Republican National Convention coming to New York City. And I think that's pretty telling, and it needs to be understood before the conversation even starts, because there's a lot of fear-mongering going on by the NYPD, by the FBI, and by some of the local tabloids. And that sort of flies in the face of the fear-mongering. But as far as what kind of events you can see at the RNC, I think there's going to be large marches. I think there is, for August 31st, there is a day of nonviolent civil disobedience and direct action planned. There is going to be very large bike rides. There's a Poor People's March on August 30th. I think there's going to be just a very large amount of different events that are all really diverse and welcome in to New Yorkers that don't want the RNC here.
Direct action. What does that mean?
It means taking action which directly affects that in which you're in opposition to. In this case, we're talking about the RNC, so direct action could be, blocking the streets. It could be anything from, unpermitted action, sort of like not requiring, not asking the government for a permit. As I see it, we have our permit. It's called the U.S. Constitution. And the idea that we're going to put ourselves in these dangerous metal barricades and, be subject to all their regulations and allow ourselves to be trampled by horses and bag searches, I find all that unconstitutional, and I think it's extraneous, really.
What about this argument? You are undemocratic. The Republican Party is one of the two major parties in the United States. It wants to meet in New York to deliberate, to discuss policy. Why on earth shouldn't it be able to do so?
Well, for the most part, I think that we have to look at the decision of why the RNC is here. I think the RNC is here because they really enjoy the symbol of New York City, the idea that it's diverse, it's an open city. Here's a city that dealt with the largest terrorist attack in history on American soil. But the fact is they're not really supportive. The money is not coming to New York City. The firehouses have been closing. Tom DeLay even suggested to house delegates in a yacht on the Hudson, which would have totally screwed many local businesses in Midtown. The other thing is that you have to consider that the people that invited the RNC here is a combination of Mayor Michael Bloomberg and rich business elite people, corporate presidents and whatnot in New York City, people that are involved that stand to gain a lot of money from this convention coming here.
I mean, are you really saying that the Republican Party doesn't have the right to meet in an American city. I mean, that's an incredible thing to say.
I'm not saying they don't have the right. I'm saying that it should be okay with the people that are there. And like I said, the recent poll suggesting that 83% of people don't want the RNC here, I think that if it was put up for referendum, people would have rejected it. And yes, they would have to go to a friendlier city.
Are you trying to make your point in these various protests that are planned, or are you actually trying to disrupt it, to stop this convention functioning?
Well, I think that it is going to function, but I think that they need to understand that the city that they are hosting their convention is, their little re-coronation party, is not popular, and that in fact the values of New Yorkers are counter to the Republican Party. We have a city that is tremendously diverse, that is very open to immigrants, and yet here's a party that is detaining immigrants since 9/11, people on absolutely no evidence, deporting people. That's just one example. I mean, never mind the fact that, like, New York is very welcome to queer communities, and this is, you know, they're having Rick Santorum speak on prime time. I don't understand how they can, you know, get away with this. The point is, we want to send a message to them that, yes, they're not welcome, and that we're totally opposed to their whole administration and their whole value system, basically.
Now, I understand you've been organizing or working on this, anyway, for over a year now.
Yes.
Is it true that your organization has been receiving information from people like staff at hotels and so on who are disgruntled and who are telling you where people attending the convention are going to be staying, that kind of thing?
Yes. Well, the information about where the delegates are staying is quite public, but we've certainly helped promote that information. But we have received a number of different voicemails and emails from different people, working class people in New York City, that, you know, for one reason or another, probably because they don't like the Republicans and for all the reasons I stated, decided to share information for us. In some ways, we put it out there that we wanted this information, and we've received it in full. Some of the information we have that we've publicized already are RNC events, fundraisers, where the delegates are staying. We have some other information that we're going to be releasing in the next couple of days for people to, you know, go to their parties and protest them. I think that the reason why we publicize the events is because the whole, you know, as has been reported in the media lately, the conventions, modern conventions, are a joke. They're not really where business is done. They're just a horse and pony show, or a dog and pony show, excuse me. I think really where the business is at is in these parties. I think the business between the Republicans and the local politicians and local business leaders happen outside the convention and at these parties, these local benefits and fundraisers at fancy New York City restaurants that most people in New York can't even afford to go to, even if they wanted to.
Jamie Moran, thanks very much for joining us today. And let me introduce two more of our guests this hour. Nathan Sales is a former Justice Department official. He left the department 9 months ago, now a lawyer in Washington. And we also have Donna Lieberman, the executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, who, as we'll hear, are getting quite closely involved in the preparations for the convention. Now, Nathan Sales, first of all, what's your take on what you've just heard?
Well, good morning, Owen, and thank you for having me on your program. Obviously, since 9/11, the issue of the relationship between civil liberties on the one hand and the necessity for security and safety on the other has been at the forefront of many people's minds. And the discussions and debates that we've been having since the Democratic National Convention about where that line should be drawn in the context of national political conventions is just one example of that. My understanding is that the FBI and New York City Police Department officials are good, solid, working-class Americans who aren't out to violate people's civil liberties. They're out to keep people safe. They've taken an oath to support and defend the Constitution, and they take that oath seriously. And in the course of tracking down and following leads that they may have received about possible criminal activity, we should expect that they would follow every investigative tip that they've received to see whether there is a there. My understanding is that's exactly what's going on in Boston and in New York. NYPD and FBI officials receive specific information that a specific individual may be planning or may have knowledge of a specific crime.
Okay, we're going to get onto that sort of issue in a moment, actually, because we'll be talking to someone who was visited by the FBI, and we'll give you the opportunity to focus in on that particular issue then. I was just wondering at this point whether you could tell us what your take is on whether it's necessary for protesters to stay within very tight limits, you know, designated areas, only just doing little rallies and so on, or whether you think it's legitimate to do these rather broader things, direct action, actually disrupting meetings. What's your view on that?
Well, as to direct action, you know, Mr. Moran spoke of having a permit to conduct protest activity, and that permit being the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. Well, lots of people have that permit. Political parties have that permit, too. In fact, it's precisely to safeguard the rights of political organizations that the First Amendment exists. The First Amendment isn't just for unaffiliated organizations. So I would say, to the same extent that Mr. Moran and his colleagues have a right to register their disagreement with the policies of the president or the policies of Senator Kerry, so too do the Democratic Party and the Republican Party have a right to assemble in a city of their choosing to take their messages to the American people.
Okay, Donna Lieberman from the New York Civil Liberties Union, you should be defending the right of the Republican Party to gather and to discuss policy in New York with the same ferocity and energy as you defend the rights of the protesters.
Of course, the New York Civil Liberties Union would defend the right of the parties to hold their conventions wherever they choose. Fortunately, we don't have to do that. That's quite well taken care of by the city and the federal government. I think the critical point is that everybody has to be allowed the opportunity to express themselves. And that goes for the conventions as well as the protesters. There are certain intimations in what Jamie said about the conditions of protest that are actually quite inaccurate. The city has, in the past, used these metal pens to fence in and corral and restrict the movement of protesters. But in fact, a recent federal court order prohibits them from using pens in that way, and in fact requires them to ensure that people have free access to and from demonstrations. When the city cordons off streets, it has to make sure that people are informed how they can get to protest activities. And when the city also is prohibited from engaging in, you know, generalized suspicionless searches of people as a condition to go to demonstration. So a lot of constraints have been placed on the city that are consistent with safety. In fact, the police department acknowledges that they're consistent with preserving law and order and as well protect the right to protest.
Donna, are you satisfied that there are enough designated areas to allow people properly to express their opinion?
You know, if you go to the New York Civil Liberties Union's website, NYCLU.org, you'll see a calendar list of events. Events are taking place all over the city, all throughout convention week and before and quite probably after. There's a march over the Brooklyn Bridge to City Hall Park. United for Peace and Justice is being allowed to march right past Madison Square Garden up 7th Avenue. There are rallies permitted right at 31st and 8th Avenue, which is the south corner of Madison Square Garden, right within sight and sound of the convention center. So permits have been granted. There's, of course, one glaring exception, and that needs to be rectified. And the Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Constitutional Rights are in court on that right, you know, this very moment, which has to do with Central Park.
We'll pick up after the break. Thanks very much for the moment, Donna Lieberman and Nathan Sales. If you want to call the number 1-800-423-8255, I'm Owen Bennett-Jones. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Owen Bennett-Jones in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection, and we're talking about the upcoming Republican National Convention in New York and how you balance civil liberties and the need for security in an age of terror. And now we're going to be asking particularly about the FBI's questioning of activists. My guests for the hour are Donna Lieberman, the executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, and Nathan Sales, a Washington lawyer who used to be with the Justice Department. If you want to join in, the number 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Let's just get more on this business of the FBI questioning people ahead of the convention. I have on the line now Sarah Bardwell. Now, she's a 21-year-old intern with the American Friends Service Committee in Denver, Colorado. It's a Quaker public service organization. She's active in the anti-war protest movement and says that 4 weeks ago the FBI turned up at her house. So, Sarah, tell us what happened then.
It was about 3-4 weeks ago, and four FBI agents and two Denver police came to our house, and my roommate was on the front porch, and they told him that he should come and get the rest of us, and so they followed him through the house, and we all went out onto the front porch, and they told us that they were doing preemptive investigations into suspected terrorists, and then they started interrogating us and asking us questions about if we had any plans of planning criminal activity at the RNC or DNC, or if we knew anybody that did have any of those plans.
Now, were you planning to go to the convention to protest?
No, none of us were.
All right. So what, did you have any idea why the FBI turned up then?
I think that the presence of the FBI at our house and at another house in Denver at the very same time and at several other people who have been visited in Colorado is because these people have been active in the anti-war movement, and there's been quite a bit of police brutality and innocent people shot by the Denver police in Denver in the past few years and have been active in the anti-police brutality protests. And I think that their goal was to intimidate people from expressing their disapproval of the government and intimidate them from going to the RNC or DNC, though I don't think that any of them were even planning to do that. But I think primarily their goal was to intimidate people out of using their First Amendment rights.
Well, as you probably know, Sarah, the FBI has confirmed that members of its local joint terrorism task force did question you and your housemates. I can just ask you to listen now to what they said about it. In fact, this is Mark Carallo of the Justice Department. And he said that the FBI doesn't conduct investigations like this without good reason. He made these comments in a recent report on NPR.
There must be some intelligence or a tip, in layman's terms, that individuals are either about to or have committed criminal acts. There is no First Amendment protection for criminal activity. We all know that.
Right. Well, there you go, Sarah. It may have been a bad tip, but they were following leads, weren't they?
I mean, that's a really interesting point that he made there, because the Denver police, for the past 25 years, and there was a lawsuit about this that made it illegal for them to do this, have been keeping spy files on peaceful protesters who were simply expressing their First Amendment rights. And it wouldn't surprise me if the Denver police did, in fact, give them tips that they're from these files that there were people who were expressing their First Amendment rights. But I don't think that they were being given tips that there were terrorists that were, you know, planning these criminal activities.
We don't know that, do we? I mean, just let's put it like this. If the FBI received a tip that someone was planning illegally to disrupt this very important part of the democratic exercise, the Republican National Convention, then presumably you would accept that in the defense of democracy, the FBI would have to follow that lead, even if it turned out to be a false lead.
But there's a difference between investigating what you consider to be a real threat to public safety and showing up on people's doorsteps to just chat, as they called it, ask questions, intimidate, take notes on them. What they were doing was coming into our house with notes. They didn't specifically say who they were coming for. They said that they were given an address that they were supposed to come and investigate. Not a person, but an address. An address cannot plan a criminal activity, and they came simply to take notes on the things that they saw inside of our house. They were taking notes on people's bicycles. They spent way more time taking notes on their surroundings and the things in our house than they did actually trying to get answers out of us. And I think that, to me, is a clear indicator that they're not trying to prevent criminal activity, but they're trying to keep people from expressing their First Amendment rights and keep people from expressing themselves against government policies.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us, Sarah Bardwell there from Denver. And let me bring in Nathan Sales, the former Justice Department official, to comment on this. I must say, Nathan Sales, one odd feature of Sarah Bardwell's story and I think other people who've had similar experiences, is that this seems very sort of informal. These guys turn up from the FBI, knock on the door saying they want to chat. I mean, that doesn't sound like a legal process.
Well, on the contrary, Owen, it is. And the fact that this sort of information gathering is proceeding in such an informal way, I think, is evidence that the FBI and the Denver Police Department and other law enforcement officials have precisely calibrated the necessary balance between civil liberties on the one hand and the demands of security on the other. This is a standard investigative technique. A tip comes in to the FBI before impaneling a grand jury, before issuing subpoenas, before any of the compulsory or coercive type investigative techniques that are used upon the issuance of a court order. It's standard operating procedure for law enforcement officials to just sort of check out the leads, have a conversation with the people who are named in a tip. And these conversations, I might add, are in fact chats. They're voluntary. A citizen can, in his or her discretion, decide to participate in the conversation and share whatever information he or she may have.
Nathan, given
they
that,
can decide not to participate.
Yeah, and given that these people weren't even planning to go to the convention, so it does seem to have been a false tip, a bad lead, do you think it would be appropriate for the agents who, you know, interfered with these people to the extent of going into their house, should apologize?
I don't think law enforcement should ever apologize for taking minimally necessary steps to preserve public safety. Can you imagine the outcry that would happen if the FBI had received a tip that a number of people were planning on going to the Democratic convention.
Point taken, but I mean,
and they didn't follow up on it.
No, absolutely. I'm not challenging that point at all, but I'm just asking you, if the lead was false, which on this occasion it seems to be, because they weren't even planning to go, then, you know, it seems appropriate to say, well, I'm sorry, we bothered you, doesn't it?
Well, I'm not sure that the tip is false. Obviously, Sarah and her friends
differ.
Aren't planning.
Well, I'll bring you in a minute, Donna, yep.
Okay.
We don't know if the tip was Sarah and her friends are planning on committing criminal activity, which obviously is not the case, especially since they weren't even planning on being at the conventions. Or, on the other hand, whether the tip was Sarah and her friends may know about criminal activity that other people who are planning on going to the convention may be about to commit. So until we know exactly what the tip is, I don't think we can say whether it's true or false. Obviously, if the tip were they're going to the convention, it's false. But if the tip is they may know something, then I'm not so sure.
All very hypothetical. Donna Lieberman, what do you reckon?
Well, I think that history tells us that the FBI and many branches of local law enforcement just either can't or don't want to tell the difference between legitimate, lawful, peaceful protest activity, the loyal opposition, which is in the best traditions of our democracy, and terrorism that they are obligated to investigate. For example, the Denver Police Department not only had spy files, but they included the American Friends Service Committee, a well-known Quaker organization that once received the Nobel Peace Prize on their list of criminal extremist groups. In Iowa, when a group of National Lawyers Guild people at Drake University organized an anti-war seminar, they were served with subpoenas demanding their attendance list and demanding from the university membership lists of the National Lawyers Guild. When Peace Fresno was engaged in suburban peace activities, they learned when an individual got killed in a car crash, a member of their group, that this man was a member of the local police department. In Denver, one of the individuals, I'm not sure where it was, but one individual was, I think, in Missouri, visited by the FBI after repeated attempts to get in touch with him, not at his home when he returned phone calls, but at work. This is intimidating. People in Missouri were followed around, and their friends with whom they were staying when they went to testify before the grand jury were followed around the city for days. And,
okay,
of course, people received questions and criticisms by their employers. Why is the FBI following you? The FBI...
We got the point. Let's throw this out to some callers, and then you can respond to that, and Nathan too. And we've got one now, Dave from Bolton, Massachusetts. Dave.
Hi, good morning. I've been listening to the show so far, and I do have a couple observations. Some of the comments that Nathan Sales has made have bothered me, specifically the comment that it's basically incumbent upon the FBI and the police department to follow up on any possible leads and basically leave no stone unturned. If we leave any, if we see any tip or any piece of information, we absolutely must follow up on it. What bothers me is this has been taken to the farthest extreme. Has any and evidence in Boston recently? I'm from Boston. Kind of points out the problem where specifically the Fourth Amendment has been basically run over by a truck. I take it as an example, the policy that was put in place that anybody's bags on public transportation may be searched. And if the person refuses to have that bag searched, then they can be removed or arrested. Now, this doesn't really sound like a specific credible threat or tip about a specific individual or a situation. If the tip was, I can hear it, I'll make a tip right now. Somebody may or may not possibly bring some sort of device on such and such a public transportation. Now, does that mean it gives the police and the FBI the right now to run over the Fourth Amendment and search everybody's bags? And if they cannot, if they refuse that, then they can be arrested. This is where I feel that the line has been crossed dramatically into the absurd, where anybody's civil liberties are basically run over in the quote-unquote interest of national security or interest in safety. I have another example.
That's fine, Dave. Take your point, and let me put it to Nathan Sales that basically following leads and investigating these things requires judgment, and the truth is the FBI does not have the confidence of many people that it is exercising that judgment properly.
Well, that's an excellent question, and I thank Dave for asking it. Any time the FBI or any other law enforcement agency receives information, they have to make an assessment of its credibility. They have to decide whether the informant who provided them with the tip is believable, whether in the past, and all sorts of different factors go into making that determination, whether this person has provided information in the past, whether the person's story is internally consistent. There are a whole variety of criteria that are used to assess the credibility. And it's only when there's some threshold determination that the information is credible that the FBI or any other law enforcement official begins to act on it. And that's necessarily so because these entities and these individuals have scarce and limited resources. They don't have the time to track down every single tip that comes in, especially those that are not credible. So it's a triage system, right? Those that are deemed most credible are followed up. Those that are not credible are not followed up on. Now, as to the searching of bags randomly, I think Dave might have been confusing two discrete types of investigative activity. One is receiving a tip and following up on it as to a specific crime, as to a specific individual. Another is investigative techniques that are used at possible venues for crime or possible venues for terrorist activity. This sort of situation happens all the time when you go to the airport, right? You get on an airplane. What do? You go through the metal detector. You take off your shoes. You run them through the magnetometer. That's the sort of technique that is used at venues of possible attacks that, in order to stave off disaster, are used even in the absence of some sort of credible tip.
Okay, Nathan, let's go to New York now. And Donna, I'll ask you to respond to this caller in a moment. It's Chris calling from New York City. Chris.
Yes, sir. I'd like to respond. The FBI has a responsibility to follow up on every single lead, no matter how insignificant it may seem. If they kick down your door in the middle of the night and drag you out, if they follow you, if they yell at you, if they threaten your job, if they turn the IRS in after you, then that's harassment. That is intimidation. But to have a casual talk is a kind, gentle way to do it. And to not do that, they would be remiss in their responsibilities. No stone must be left unturned. And as a New York City resident, I absolutely disagree with the first. I think his name was Moran. We welcome the Republican National Convention. It brings business to the city, badly needed business, particularly since September 11th. And we welcome it wholeheartedly.
Donna Lieberman.
You know, we all want and rely on the FBI and local law enforcement to follow up on credible leads, but it hurts our national security, and it undermines our right to dissent when the FBI is out there questioning people, interrogating people, visiting them at their work, simply because they are engaged in lawful, peaceful protest activities, simply because they are the loyal opposition. The FBI has a notorious history in the bad old days of showing up at people's works, at showing up and talking to the neighbors about people who are suspected of being communists or other undesirables. And too many people have been hurt by those tactics. The FBI has a terrible history of infiltrating political organizations and even proposing illegal activity in those organizations. That's why there are limits ordered by courts on political surveillance. They have no business engaging in surveillance, infiltration, and interrogation of people simply because they are doing what people have the right to do in a democracy, which is to criticize their government. And that remains the case with regard to the Republican convention, the Democratic convention, and everyday life.
Chris, in New York, fair point, isn't it? There is an unfortunate history here.
Well, there may be, but we're not talking about history. We're talking about the now of reality now. Is she suggesting that the FBI should ignore tips and leads? Is that what you're saying?
I think you weren't listening. What I'm suggesting is that the FBI has to distinguish between lawful dissent, which is as American as apple pie and which we rely on for our democracy to thrive, and real threats of terrorism. And if they waste their time and energy going after Sarah Bardwell and the people who went to an anti-war conference in Iowa, then we are less safe because they are they're wasting their time on hurting people who are exercising their rights, and they're not focusing on the real problem.
Mom sitting there.
Say that again, Chris. We didn't catch that.
They walked in Sarah's house and saw somebody making a bomb. I mean, how would they determine whether or not this person is safe? Apparently, to determine she's safe, they walked away. That was the end of it. I don't have a problem. My tax dollars having them walk in, say hello. I'll be happy to talk to them anytime. But if you're descending and somebody thinks that you might be planning violence or obstructing people's right to meet as they are in New York City, maybe they need to take a look at that. Maybe they didn't look hard enough pre-September 11th, and maybe now they're just doing their job.
Chris, thanks very much. Chris from New York City there. We'll be back with Donna Lieberman and Nathan Sales just after the break. You're listening to The Connection on NPR, and we're talking about the Republican National Convention, how to balance protesters' rights against the police's duty to keep the streets safe. If you want to join in, the number 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255 or 423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Owen Bennett-Jones in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection, and we're talking about free speech and safety at the upcoming RNC in New York. My guests, Nathan Sales, a Washington lawyer and former Justice Department official, and Donna Lieberman, Executive Director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. The number 1-800-423-8255. Before we take some calls, Donna, I just want to put this one point to you, really feeding off what Chris said there in New York. He mentioned 9/11 and the need to be vigilant. I mean, it is the case, isn't it, that if something terrible happened and the FBI, it turned out afterwards, had a lead and didn't follow it up, everyone would be on their case.
Well, I think that the...
That's a dilemma for them, isn't it? It's a dilemma for them.
Well, no, what the 9/11 Commission report tells us is that, in fact, they had lots of information, but they didn't connect the dots.
Right, this is what I'm saying. So they now have to connect dots.
No. But they were overwhelming themselves with information that was irrelevant, and they did not go for the jugular. They did not follow up the leads that they should have been following up. And it's critical that we understand that diverting your resources into going after peaceful, lawful protest is precisely what the FBI has done over time with regard to political dissenters, and it's what they have been doing now as well. It's not like we don't have any information about this. We know that they wrongly went after people in Iowa, and when they were exposed, they withdrew the subpoenas. We know that the Denver police went after the American Friends Service Committee as a criminal extremist group, and they're under court order not to do that anymore. There are reasons for this. There's a bad history with the FBI. We need them to do their job well. We don't need them to go after political protests with a blunt instrument.
Now, the connection reaches far and wide, as far as Taipei in Taiwan. Carmen has just called in from there. Carmen.
Good evening. Good morning, rather, for you. I just wanted to note that it does seem that they're kind of, it's a little too easy to make a little tip here if they're just giving out addresses. I mean, it seems to me that it's possible that the Denver police, who just didn't really care for some particular protest group in their area because, you know, maybe they felt harassed or whatnot, or they made them work a little bit more by having to secure certain areas.
Tell you what, someone else is, you've got a cross line there, Carmen. But thanks very much, Carmen. I mean, let me just put the point you made to Nathan Sales, which surely is a valid point, that there is nothing easier than tipping off the police with false information to harass or intimidate someone who you might have a personal enmity with. It happens all over the world, and maybe it's happening here.
That's a possibility. That's always a possibility, not just in connection with criminal activity that may involve political speech rights, but also in connection with any other sort of criminal activity. And that's a balance that has to be calibrated every time a tip comes in to a law enforcement agency. And as I think I mentioned a little bit before, there's an entire rubric that is followed by law enforcement officials when deciding whether a tip is credible. Now, as far as where do you draw the line, when you're dealing with very serious allegations of very serious criminal activity, the sorts of crimes that would inflict mass casualties, if there is the slightest bit of doubt, the question arises, well, do we follow it up? Do we pursue the lead? Or do we let it go? And
yeah,
I think the answer to that question has to vary depending on the severity of the crime that's being investigated.
Sure, but it's just not plausible, is it, to say that these are tips about mass casualties and this kind of thing? Because if it was that serious, you wouldn't just go around and have a little chat with someone. That's the problem, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure that's right. And let me remind you and your listeners about some of the concerns about criminal activity at the Democratic National Convention up in Boston. You'll remember that there was information in the media about a plot to throw Molotov cocktails at news vans, a subject near and dear to your heart, I'm sure. And the FBI, rightly regarding this as a very serious crime involving not just property damage or bodily injury, but potential death, drew the line in a way that enabled them to follow up on the tips that came in. So I think we are talking about very, very serious crimes, and we are talking about a need to follow those investigative tips to their fruition in a way that wouldn't be present for a garden variety traffic offense, for instance.
Frank, calling from Boston. Hi, Frank.
Hi, thanks. I just want to chime in and agree with Chris in New York. I think we're dealing with a totally new ball game now. After the first World Trade Center attack in 93, the ball was dropped, and 9/11 happened less than 10 years later. And for 8 years, an administration sat in Washington and played games, and look what happened. Now the FBI is getting their act together. Yeah, they don't have the greatest history, and they've dropped the ball on plenty of other things. But they're doing the job now. And if you don't have anything to fear, you'd be okay with a search of a bag on a train or anywhere else. Or if you're in a political organization and they have reason to search, so be it. There's 3,000 dead. It's common sense. We're going on the offensive worldwide. People have had enough. And I think there's a silent majority out there in this country that agrees with the policies that are in place because they don't forget 9/11.
Okay, Frank, just stay on the line. I'd like you to hear what Andrea has to say from Worcester, Massachusetts. Andrea.
Sure. Hello, thank you for taking my call. I beg to disagree with the previous caller because in the first place, the attackers of the World Trade Center on 9/11 and 93 were organized crime, were Al-Qaeda members, and were not college students. So let's not kid ourselves. Why is Osama bin Laden still free? Because the FBI is wasting their resources on peaceful protesters. Now, I have firsthand experience from friends of mine from a group called Wogan in Worcester that has been harassed and intimidated by the FBI just because they got together, they went to the protests, and they showed a couple of videos in a basement about sustainable living. Now tell me what is the crime there, and tell me what is the justification for the FBI to be following around college students from Worcester that go to UMass and to the Holy Cross instead of pursuing the real leads that need to be pursued in order to really fight terrorism. How is that defending democracy? Democracy is based on diversity of opinion. We don't want a totalitarian regime here in which everybody thinks the same or else, like in Chile under Pinochet. These, let's call it by their name, these are intimidation tactics.
Frank, these are intimidation tactics.
Well, I wish somebody intimidated and harassed Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma City. Okay, he wasn't exactly a college student, but I don't care if he went to Holy Cross, MIT, or UMass. You got to do your job and connect the dots and find out who's up to what. And if you're paranoid about it and you think that the world's coming to an end and the Bush administration, the FBI's out to get you, that's too bad. Better safe than sorry, and I'm all for it.
Andrea, better safe than sorry.
Safe. Safe, but who are we trying to pursue here? We're trying to find people from Al-Qaeda and from other members of other groups that are proliferating right now due to the horrible U.S. policies. Now, what is this administration afraid of, trying to persecute people that are practicing the First Amendment rights? What kind of a democracy? This looks more and more and more like a totalitarian regime to me.
Thanks very much, Andrea. Thanks, too, to Frank in Boston. Nathan Sales, it's a totalitarian regime.
Boy, I thought that I was having a bad day. doesn't look like one to me. Totalitarian regimes do not allow protesters to caricature the president. Totalitarian regimes do not allow former veterans of Vietnam to criticize Senator Kerry. This is very far from a totalitarian regime. And one of the reasons why we're very far from a totalitarian regime is because law enforcement respects First Amendment rights in a way that historically they have not. And you know, I don't want to disagree with Donna on everything, so I will agree with her that, it's undeniable from the historical record. Law enforcement does have a very sorry history of failing to respect people's First Amendment rights. The infiltration of Martin Luther King's organization during the 1960s and 1970s by RFK's Justice Department is perhaps the best example of that. And nobody has, let me just say this, it's not just political activists and professional politicians who have an interest in the FBI not infiltrating peaceful organizations. The FBI itself has an interest in not infiltrating peaceful organizations where no criminal activity is afoot because they have scarce resources. FBI knows that it has a job to do, and that's to keep us all safe by using lawful investigative techniques.
Isn't that a really bad argument? I mean, you're basically saying it was bad in the past, but it's okay now.
Well, what I was going to get to was the numerous institutional safeguards, legal safeguards that are in place now to prevent the abuses of the 1960s and 1970s from happening again. Congress has acted to sharply curtail the FBI's ability to obtain information on American citizens and non-American citizens alike. Courts now play a much more active role at the initial stages of an investigation in determining when law enforcement can collect information, what methods they can use to collect information, what can be done with the information once it's collected. We've come a long way since the days of J. Edgar Hoover, and we're better for it, not only because civil liberties are protected more now than ever before, but also because the focus of law enforcement activity is now not diverted to irrelevancies.
Donna Lieberman, how true is that? If you've got a direct interest in this, you try and defend people who find themselves in these situations. When you go to the courts, are there protections there?
Well, I think you don't even have to go to court to understand that this administration has systematically done everything that it can to undermine our civil liberties and civil rights. We have a government that has a fetish about secrecy. We have a government that has adopted the Patriot Act, which provides for secret subpoenas, secret national security letters, which make an end run around the courts in order to gather information about individuals based on flimsy affirmations that aren't even tested in court. I think that we're in serious trouble when we have a Justice Department that goes on record telling us that it considers domestic terrorism to include the Vieques protests, which involved civil disobedience, a time-honored form of protest that doesn't involve violence, and considers Greenpeace to be involved in terrorist activity. I think our civil liberties are deeply in trouble.
My question really was this. Do the laws offer more protection, and you presumably try to use those laws, do they offer more protection to people like Sarah Bardwell, who we heard from earlier, than existed 40 years ago, let's say, or 30
years
ago.
Yes, the constant. Well, I wouldn't say they offer us more protection. What we have that has, you know, been with us for a couple of hundred years is the United States Constitution, and the Bill of Rights is still intact, and it prevents. It prohibits the government from engaging in suspicionless searches, even in the name of national security. You know, the court dealt with that issue in the Nixon era when they proposed a national security exception to the Fourth Amendment privacy protections. So the Constitution is still with us, and organizations like the American Civil Liberties Union and the NYCLU here in New York are dedicated to protecting and preserving those rights. And I think it's important to note that, you know, one difference between the public response in the 50s and now. In the 50s, when the FBI came to your door, people were intimidated. They were frightened and afraid to express their political beliefs, lest they be labeled communists. In the 90s, people like Sarah Bardwell are coming forward to expose and criticize the FBI when they improperly go after her for being, God forbid, anti-war. And I think that's an important distinction. And people don't have to answer the FBI when they come to their door. The one piece of advice that the ACLU would give is that people should call us, call a lawyer before you talk to them.
Nathan Sales, good advice?
What if the person has evidence or knowledge of potential criminal activity? Should they withhold that information? I think the question answers itself. What if they don't?
Yeah.
Well, if they don't, then the FBI will say, thank you, mister, thank you, ma'am, and be on its way.
No, but I mean, if... You know,
Every citizen has a right to refuse to comply with a voluntary request for a voluntary interview. Nobody is being forced to turn over information when the FBI says, will you please talk to me? But I would hope that after all of us witnessed the incredible devastation that can be wrought by terrorist attacks, that people who do have information will voluntarily come forward and provide that to the FBI, not because they feel intimidated or coerced into doing so, but because they too have a stake in security and safety and the preservation not just of American liberties but of American lives.
Nathan Sales, thank you very much. Washington lawyer and former Justice Department official Nathan Sales there. And also thanks to Donna Lieberman from the ACLU in New York, the executive director there. And earlier, we spoke with Jamie Moran. He's the co-founder of the rncnotwelcome.org website. And Sarah Bardwell, an intern at American Friends Service Committee in Denver, Colorado, who was visited by the FBI. If you want to go to our website or continue the conversation, you can always take a look at www.theconnection.org. I'm Owen Bennett-Jones, and this is The Connection. We'll be right back.